Hi, and welcome back to another edition of Sea Control, a podcast series brought to you by the Centre of International Maritime Security. My name is Natalie Sambi, and I'm an analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra, and I'm also host of Sea Control's Asia-Pacific series. Today, we'll be discussing foreign fighters in the Middle East. I'll be bringing you the podcast in two parts. My first guest is Mr. Andrew Zammit, a researcher at Monash University's Global Terrorism Research Centre in Melbourne. And followed by my second guest, Mr. Levi West, a lecturer in terrorism and national security at Charles Sturt University here in Canberra. Before we do that, though, I'll be back after this short break.
Hola, nuestros amigos. Do you like Sea Control? Do you enjoy the SimSec Next World blog? Become part of the discussion and our community. Sign up for SimSec membership at www.simsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and podcasts emailed to you every week, and an account that allows you to submit articles directly to our editors through WordPress. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, but it's nothing without your constant support and engagement. Your ideas keep us going. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
And welcome back. I'm Natalie Sambi. As mentioned, we'll be talking today about developments over in the Middle East and foreign fighters who have gone to those areas from countries like Australia and the United States and the United Kingdom in order to join the fight. My guest today is Andrew Zammit, a researcher at Monash University's Global Terrorism Research Centre. Welcome, Andrew, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew, let's just start today with telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and your research.
Okay. I work at the Global Terrorism Research Centre at Monash University. I was hired there a few years ago to be part of a major research project looking at violent extremism in Australia or that affects Australia overseas, that's Indonesia. I involved a team of about 10 people or so, involved interviewing about 80 current or former violent extremists and about 20 law enforcement officials, going through a lot of court documents and producing a large amount of publications. It was a very fun project, which has largely wound up now, and now I'm just doing a bit of research on the involvement of Australians in the Syria conflict, which is one of the number one terrorism concern for Australia at the moment.
Excellent. And why is that at the moment? Why are Australians fighting in Syria such a concern for the Australian government right now?
They're a concern because of the large numbers that are believed to be over there fighting, and that it exceeds any previous cases of Australians going and joining and fighting with jihadist groups overseas.
Right, and what do we know about the numbers of Australians right now?
There's a lot of different estimates that get thrown around in the media, and just a couple of weeks ago a lot of media reports were claiming there are 300 Australians fighting, which is very implausible, but some far more plausible figures were actually announced by the Attorney General just last night. It's estimated there's currently 60 Australians fighting with extremist groups in Syria and Iraq, namely with the al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra, or the former al-Qaeda affiliate, the Islamic State of Iraq, now Sham, or the Islamic State, it's now called, having changed its name about 2 days ago. So the 60 figure, which is the number currently fighting, doesn't encompass the whole phenomenon. There's been about 10 or so Australians believed to have died fighting in the conflict so far. There's an estimate that 20 or so have fought and returned. There's also people who are over there involved with the groups who are not actively fighting, and there's also believed to be people in Australia who are supporting it, such as by funding or facilitating fighters. And so the current estimate is that there's around 150 Australians materially involved in some way, whether in Australia or over in the region.
Just on the fighters, the Australians who are in the region who are not fighting, what kind of activities are they usually engaged in?
Some might be, for example, doing aid work, but doing it directly for one of the armed factions and in areas they control. They might be, say, in Lebanon or Turkey, providing money or helping fighters go over. In one case, for example, we have a former Sydney sheikh who has a role in the Sharia Council of Jabhat al-Nusra, so he doesn't actively fight, but he describes himself and is described by the group as one of their leading members.
Right.
And will give all sorts of announcements, and he will put forward their public positions in English on a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so obviously, I mean, not only the Attorney General, but other parts of the Australian government and law enforcement agencies have expressed concern about this, these developments. Why does this matter?
It matters essentially because of the concern that some of them might either return to Australia and carry out violence here, or return to other countries and carry out violence. And there is essentially jihadist terrorist plots across the world have often resulted from people travelling to these sorts of conflict zones mm-hmm. and extremist groups for the past 20 to 30 years. So Al-Qaeda itself was formed from groups of Saudis and Egyptians who were fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan. Many terror plots in the UK came from people who travelled to Pakistan to fight in Kashmir, who were mm-hmm. then persuaded by groups there to go back to London and carry out attacks there. The 9/11 hijackers, for example, initially travelled to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets, who were then persuaded to carry out this attack against America. So these fears of Syria blowback causing terrorist attacks at home is based on what we've seen with jihadist movement over 20 to 30 years or so.
I see. And yes. I'm just going to deviate for a second to Jamar Islamia, yeah. Just to, you know, give a little bit more background to some of our listeners. Obviously, for Australia, and terrorism, one of the most significant incidents to occur to Australians was the Bali bombing in 2002 that occurred, on which 88 Australians were killed and a number of Indonesians and other nationalities were also harmed. That was carried about the terrorist organisation Jamar Islamia, who had sanctuary for a while under Abu Bakar Bashir in Malaysia. But were actually comprised of people who had foreign fighting experience and training in Afghanistan. Is that right, Andrew?
That's correct. The fighting and training in Afghanistan and also Pakistan was crucial to the development of the most extreme elements of Indonesian jihadism.
Right.
So in the mid-1980s, Abu Bakar Bashir and Abdullah Sunkar, when they were based in Malaysia, arranged for many of their followers to go fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. Some fought with Osama bin Laden, others trained in jihadist camps in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. And these mm-hmm. came to be called the Afghan Alumni.
Yep.
And they would then play leading roles in the formation of JAI, which was officially formed at the end of 1993, and were involved in attacks such as the Bali bombings, and played a role in organising leading subsequent attacks, such as the Marriott bombings, the Australian Embassy bombing, and the second Bali bombing.
Yeah, look, I just I wanted to bring that up as well, because obviously being an Indonesia watcher, I know that this particular issue has been of concern to terrorism researchers in Indonesia, who note that there are substantial numbers of Indonesians going over to fight in Syria and Iraq. You know, for some of our listeners who may want to read a bit more into this, there was a report released earlier this year by the Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict that talked about why these kinds of conflicts were so attractive. And so what I'm trying to, you know, draw out today between you and I is that this is something that our region of the world really has to pay attention to. This is something that, you know, Australia and Indonesia might work hand in hand together. I think in the past, both Andrew and I have looked into ways in which the Australian Federal Police, as well as my colleague David Connery at ASPI as well, how the Australian Federal Police and the Indonesian National Police have built a relationship based on counterterrorism. I think it's imperative that they keep continuing that relationship. I mean, are there other countries in the region that are concerned about this foreign fighter development?
Yes, Malaysia is also concerned. I think it's estimated that 30 or so Malaysians have gone and joined these groups in Syria, and a number of people from the Philippines has as well. And the Philippines at the moment has a peace deal which seems to be going reasonably well with one of the main separatist groups in Mindanao. But there's the potential for spoilers, and some of the groups there are looking to Syria. And what's happening in Iraq is an inspiration for where to go next. But the main concern, particularly for Australia, is Indonesia, as that's where the major terrorist threats to Australia itself has come from. And Indonesian jihadist groups seem to have become a lot weaker recently. The last major bombing was 2009. Most of the violence since has been a lot smaller, often attacks only killing one or two people. But there is concern that with Indonesians fighting in Syria, or with Indonesian extremist groups who are pledging solidarity with groups like ISIS from Indonesia, that this could, over the next 10 years or so, lead to a much, much bigger threat reoccurring. I think the current estimate is that 56 Indonesians are fighting in Syria.
Yep.
But I've heard the real number could be quite a bit higher.
And just on that note of Indonesian jihadism, another point that the report, the IPAC report raises, is that they're concerned returning foreign fighters will revive weak jihadist movements. Just for our listeners, the contours of Indonesian jihadism at the moment tend to be quite weak, and they are targeting more elements of the state. So they're targeting the police and other security and law enforcement agencies, as opposed to before, like during the Bali bombings, where they were specifically targeting Western audiences. Now, Andrew, I just, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was as well, is I hear that this is quite a concern in Europe. Can you discuss that a little bit for us?
Yes. It looks like in Europe, the Syria blowback is already happening. So far, by my count, there's been 6 alleged violent plots in Europe involving Syria returnees. And these are in France, Belgium, the UK, 2 in Kosovo, and also in the Netherlands. The most well-known example is the recent murders at the Jewish Museum in Brussels, where 4 people were shot dead, allegedly by someone who had fought with ISIS. But we haven't seen any completed trials for these. They're all on trial at the moment, so they aren't definitive. But this is a problem we're going to be facing certainly over the next 10 years or so. And it does look like that for Europe, at least, the blowback has begun.
Right. And in these kinds of countries, particularly in Australia, what kinds of countermeasures are being taken?
Australia is taking a range of countermeasures at the moment, and it's being spoken about at the highest levels of government quite a lot. So there's a lot of coercive powers that can and are being used. So authorities, of course, surveilling and investigating people. There have been 3 Australians charged at the moment for either allegedly attempting to go over to fight or to support the fighters, or for sending people over to fight. We've also been confiscating passports. Our main domestic security agency, ASIO, has the ability to have passports confiscated, and has been using that quite a lot recently. So, for example, since mid-2012, about 50 to 60 Australians' passports have had their 50 to 60 Australians have had their passports confiscated by ASIO because of suspicions they're planning to travel to Syria and fight.
Right, and I mean, there's obviously a concern about people leaving and people coming back. I mean, obviously, just for our listeners of SIMSEC, there is a maritime security element to all of this. I just wondered if you could touch upon that and Operation Sovereign Borders.
I would say more it's being misportrayed by some of our political leaders to have more of a maritime, be more like a maritime security issue than it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm following on from the popularity for the current government of Operation Sovereign Borders. So that was an operation introduced because in Australia we have an ocean around us and we have boats of asylum seekers coming in. When the new government came to power, and while it was in opposition, it was treating this as a national security emergency and launched a major civilian-led but heavily militarily dependent operation to try to stop the boats from coming to Australia, and it claims that there have been no boats in the past 6 months, and has been making a large amount of political capital out of this. And the result of that is they've been trying to frame the Syria conflict in the same terms. So when our Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, has been asked about this Syria issue, he's framed it in border security terms of saying, we stop the boats, we will stop the returning jihadists.
Right. And that, as you said, isn't quite correct.
Quite a bit. It assumes, for example, or doesn't address at least, what about those who have already returned? And mm-hmm. there's some estimates of around 20 or so that have already returned. It also assumes that we can necessarily tell who the returning fighters are, but, you know, they might just be coming to Australia with, you know, their passports having said, or coming back to Australia, I should say, with their passports just saying they've been to Turkey or to Lebanon or something. Intelligence might not necessarily know that they were fighting, particularly if they weren't stupid enough to put videos up on YouTube or elsewhere about it. Even if we do know they're a returning fighter, that's very different to having enough admissible evidence to simply charge them with various offences. And there's also the potential threat from people within Australia who want to go and fight in Syria, but are prevented from doing so and then might direct their attention home. So in 2009, we actually had a terrorist plot aimed at Holsworthy Barracks in Sydney, and some of the key people in that had initially just wanted to fight with Al-Shabaab, and when prevented from doing so, directed their extremist attention closer to home. And another further problem with the border security framing is that even if the activity carried out by these Australians is outside of Australia, that's still a security concern for us.
Yep. All right. I think you've given us plenty of food for thought. I think I'll pose a couple of those issues to my second guest today, Levi West. But before I sign off with you, I just would like to point out to our listeners that if you're interested in more of Andrew's research, you can actually follow some of his writings on his blog. Andrew, would you like to just give a little shout out to your blog?
Yes, I run a blog called The Murphy Raid, which looks at security, terrorism and human rights, with a focus on Australia, but not exclusively Australia-focused. You can find it at Andrew Zammit, that's ZAMMIT.org, or just type The Murphy Raid into Google and it'll be one of the first things that comes up.
Excellent. All right. Look, thanks very much for joining us today, Andrew. That was the end of part one for today's podcast. My guest is Andrew Zammit, researcher at Monash University's Global Terrorism Research Centre, and I'll be back after this short break with my second guest, Mr. Levi West. Thanks again, Andrew.
Thank you.
Great content from the Center for International Maritime Security. Like the Sea Control podcast? It's at your fingertips. Go to www.cimsec.org. Don't forget to sign up at www.cimsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and announcements by email. And hey, if you feel inspired, feel free to write us an article or two, or five. Make sure to check out our partners. Our friends at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute produce the Sea Control Asia Pacific Edition. Our friends at the Phoenix Think Tank produce Sea Control East Atlantic. This and other fine forums can be found on our homepage. Join the discussion.
And welcome back. I'm here with my second guest for part two of today's podcast on foreign fighters, with Levi West, who's a lecturer in terrorism and national security at Charles Sturt University in Canberra. Levi, welcome and thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Just as a bit of background, would you mind just telling our audience a little bit about your research interests and what you do at at Charles Sturt?
Yeah, of course. I coordinate a master's program in terrorism and security studies. Most of the students are federal government employees, which keeps things interesting. My research interests sort of range across non-state actors broadly, so terrorism, insurgency, transnational crime, and much of that is dominated by global jihadi terrorism, and particularly interested in the way that technology intersects and changes and alters non-state actor behaviour.
Excellent. All right, so in part one with Andrew, we talked a little bit about Australians travelling over to the Middle East, Iraq and Syria, fighting, what some of the motivations are, a little bit about how that's affected jihadism in the region as well in Indonesia. What I'd like to talk a little bit more with you about is a little bit more about what are we concerned about with Australians returning from Syria, what kinds of Australians are going over there, what should we really know about these kinds of developments?
Yeah. Look, it's obviously a very, very concerning development. Australia continues to have a disproportionate representation of individuals engaged in various aspects of what's going on in both Syria and now in Iraq. The sort of spectrum of numbers range from about 150 through to 250 people involved in various aspects of what's happening over there, either with Jabhat al-Nusra or with ISIS or Islamic State, as they now refer to themselves as. Probably the most significant thing about those numbers, even if you take the 150, is that for a country with a relatively small population, our per capita representation of people involved in the conflict over there is really quite significant in global terms, which makes it a sort of tier one concern.
Right. And, I mean, just to clarify, I mean, Andrew obviously brought up two numbers. He referred to one number that was released by the Attorney General's number last night, which was significantly lower than 150. The 150 that you're talking about upwards, that includes Iraq and Syria, just for clarification. Is that correct?
Yes. My understanding is that number from AG's yesterday, day before, was around the 58 mark. And I'm reasonably confident that that was people who had gone and are involved with ISIS specifically.
Right.
The 150 to 250 number has been floating around for some time in regards to Syria and mostly to Jabhat al-Nusra. Certainly the figures that I've seen. So not to suggest that Andrew is necessarily wrong, but...
No, that's fine. So just to delve a little bit more into the profile of Australians travelling over there, I mean, Andrew and I talked about the fact that the people are going over there to fight, but they're also engaging in other kinds of activities, you know, humanitarian assistance and whatnot. Are there any other kinds of activities that Australians are engaging in that are of interest?
There are, and this is where I think the counterterrorism effort gets much more complex and difficult. So there's a couple of Australians over there who have actually holding reasonably senior ideological and religious positions within Jabhat al-Nusra. So the one, Abu Sulaiman, who has linkages to the to a particular bookshop in Western Sydney that's been a subject of much interest for some time to the authorities, went over there and was acting as a broker in the early days of the split between Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, and is now considered to be quite a significant and well-regarded ideologue and religious authority in Jabhat al-Nusra. And there's a couple more Australians who hold similar types of roles in proceedings over there. And the difficulty with that is that if you're reasonably savvy with what you're doing and you don't overtly go around advocating terrorism as such, the challenge to the authorities is then if you come home and you continue to preach everything but, then you know, it's a really difficult thing to push back on. So, we've definitely got some involvement over there on the sort of religious and ideological front as well as the sort of foot soldier.
Fair enough. And with regards to Australians returning home, I mean, one of the things I talked about earlier, you know, particularly with countries like Indonesia, is revivalist of weak jihadist movements. Specifically for Australia, what are we concerned about?
Yeah, look, there's a few different aspects to it. I think the first one is obviously the capabilities. So there are now established training camps in Syria, the further the sort of broad region of Syria and Iraq deteriorates, the more operational space you have to embed and re-establish and continue to run training camps. There is a chasm of difference between someone who has sat at home in their bedroom in the UK or Australia or the United States and read Inspire magazine and someone who spent 6 months in a training camp with veterans of the Iraq and Afghan wars being trained in weapons discipline and how to make explosives and how to build IEDs and all these types of things. So the capabilities that these guys bring home with them is enormously significant. And part of that training too, and this is where it gets particularly concerning, is that they will be getting some level of counterintelligence training, which is them in evading the authorities.
Because, I mean, obviously one of the things that Andrew brought up earlier is that, you know, we're not always in a position to be able to detect those particular people who have been fighting in those areas and the kinds of activities and skills that they have. So you're saying now that not only are they picking up those capabilities, but the ability to be able to evade authorities. Is this a new development?
You can get online and you can access all of Al-Qaeda's old documentation about basic counterintelligence training. There's a number of documents around on, you know, sort of 101 stuff. But what you'll be getting in some of those camps almost inevitably, and it's been done in most terrorist organisations, in most training camps, teach the people how to evade capture. Or more to the point, how to evade setting off red flags.
Yeah.
So old AQ stuff was to make sure that you dress like a Westerner, don't have your beard, that type of stuff. my suggestion would be that what's happening in Syria is a little much more sophisticated than that.
And I mean, that's a really interesting observation as well, because, like you say, on the one hand, it's really sophisticated, but on the other hand, you see this sort of, you know, proliferation of YouTube images and Facebook posts and Twitter, which almost suggests to me, you know, quite, you know, in some terms, loose operational security balanced against, obviously, the information warfare, a benefit of that. I mean, doesn't that suggest to you that there might be a lack of awareness of counterintelligence sort of...
I think it's worthwhile probably distinguishing between the guys who are going over there and sort of hanging around taking photos of themselves with an AK or an RPG and posting photos on Facebook.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be my sense of things, is that if you got over there and someone went, oh, hey, we might put you at a camp for 6 months, as opposed to the guy who's trying to be part of things.
Right.
And necessarily, I think it would be wrong of us to assume that everyone who goes over there to try and be a jihadi necessarily gets taken on by the organisations. And the other bit to it as well is that it's a relatively fluid conflict environment that enables you to go over there and pick up an RPG without necessarily having to become formally a member of anything at all. As far as the space is concerned, all of these things are very, very concerning.
So we're talking there about people with various levels of commitment, acceptance within these groups. I think in the pre-interview chat, we had a little bit of we talked a little bit about levels of ideological commitment and the concern that Australian authorities may have for that. Levi, do you mind speaking a little bit about that?
Yeah, certainly in the camps that were being run in Afghanistan prior to 2001, and certainly is the case with most of the camps that Lashkar-e-Taiba has run in the Pakistan-Afghan region. A substantial component of the training is religious indoctrination, or further religious indoctrination into the particular jihadi worldview that's necessary for people to engage in the activities that they're engaging in. And, like I said before about capabilities in the sort of military sense, where you're going to be an awful lot more committed if you've got 6 months of military training under your belt rather than reading Inspire magazine. The same thing goes for your level of religious commitment to the cause for which you think you're fighting. And the other component of that is the geography of that part of the world. So an often overlooked aspect of jihadi ideology is the end of days narrative in Islam, which begins with a fight in what they refer to as Khorasan, which is the broad Afghan-Pakistan region.
Right.
And that once the forces who fight under a black banner are victorious in that part of the world, they will then march west towards Jerusalem. Al-Sham, or Greater Syria, and Damascus play an enormous part in that broad narrative as well. So if you are already of the view that the religious ideology is something that you believe in, you then go to a part of the world that forms an absolutely central component of your worldview and get further indoctrinated by senior clerics of the body of thought that you believe in, then the level of commitment that you're going to have to that cause is going to be much, much greater than sitting at home reading Inspire magazine.
Right, fair enough. Just moving back for what this kind of means for Australia, is there anything that we can discuss in terms of what our authorities are doing now, how we might better tackle these kinds of, the issues of foreign fighters, what we might do as a regional response?
Yeah, look, I think the government is doing most of what it can. Certainly in some of the discussions I've had with colleagues here at work, retired senior people who did this stuff for a long, long time, is that it's essentially a question of resources. Mm-hmm. It's expensive to surveil someone. It's really expensive and really labour-intensive. It's not as simple as most people think. Not only do you have to run the surveillance, but you've then got to analyse everything you're collecting. I guess I divide what the government's doing into two things. One is the new laws around foreign incursions and making it easier to prosecute people for their involvement. That seems sort of self-evident to me. I think that's an eminently positive step. The passport one, I'm not so convinced of. It seems like a quite fundamentally parochial thing to do.
That's to revoke someone's passport.
Or to have an Australian go over to Syria and become well-trained, battle-hardened, uber-committed jihadist.
Mm-hmm.
For us to go, well, as long as you don't come back to Australia, that's the problem solved, until he shows up in France or London or, somewhere else.
It's just shipping the problem elsewhere.
I think that whilst I understand the motivation and in that same parochial sense, I support the idea. I don't exactly want them coming back here either. but I'm not sure that it's necessary. Let's assume that obviously there'd be intelligence being shared, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it seems to me to just be sort of pushing the problem offshore somewhat. And, you know, I mean, admittedly, Australia's in a quite unique position due to its geography. It makes it a little bit easier to not have people come back into the country by illegitimate means. So, you know, it looks like they're going to loosen up some of the access to computer stuff as well, which will make it a little bit easier to, I think, investigate the networks around people. But really, it's a resourcing question. You know, we've been doing a pretty reasonable job of mm-hmm. this stuff in Australia over the last 10, 15 years. The difference is that by a combination of good luck and good management, most of the people that were involved in most of the plots here were reasonably average at what they did.
Right.
You know, they weren't especially sophisticated or good terrorists. I think the problem is that we're going to have a bunch of very, very good, well, better, and better trained and more committed people come back from the conflicts in Syria and Iraq, and that's going to challenge and stretch what we do.
Right. Excellent. Some interesting observations there, Levi. Thanks very much for joining us and providing a bit more information about really what Australia will be dealing with in terms of foreign fighters returning home and the kinds of challenges there about this particular conflict as opposed to others in the past like Afghanistan. Thanks very much for being a guest on our show today, Levi.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks.
We hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher Stream Radio. Leave a comment and a 5-star rating. However, the most important thing you can do for us is to tell all of your friends. We rely on you, the loyal listener, to get out the word and foster the discussion. Looking forward to seeing you next week. Oh, you thought I meant talking to you next week. Well, that's you. But we can see you. Don't worry about it. Just remember to tell all of your friends.